This is day three of this April 2018 seven-day session. We're going to fast forward from Foyan's 12th century China to another text that seems to be around the sometime in the 16th century. This is from a book called The Practice of Zen by C.C. Chang. And this is one of the very earliest books, Zen books, translated into English. It's from 1959, puts it almost 60 years ago. It's one of the very few books that Roshi Kaplow had he could use to comment on from the old masters in Taisho. I say it seems to be in the 16th century, but it's a kind of a collection of different sources. This book has some autobiographical material and several masters, and then some discourses by some masters. The only date I could find in the whole book was the mid-1500s. So I'm just going to assume that the selections I'm going to be commenting on are from the 1500s, which, by the way, was in Europe when Michelangelo's greatest works were created. It's the time of Shakespeare. University of Berlin was founded, and work began on the Mexico City Cathedral, the great cathedral in Mexico City, which, however, wasn't finished till 1813. Mañana. So this is a selection that I haven't read in about 3 years. I haven't read from, commented on in Taisho. It's a master by the name of Shui Yen. The masters in this book, other than this book, I've never heard their names, so they're probably not the Tang Dynasty or the Sung Dynasty, but later, again, in the 1500s, it seems. He begins, "Time does not wait for people. Swiftly, your next lifetime will be upon you. Therefore, why do you not try to understand Zen and practice in earnest with a humble mind to make it transparently clear throughout? How fortunate you are to live here, surrounded by famous mountains and great lakes. How lucky you are to find yourself in a world full of Dharma teachings and great masters. Your monastery is clean and neat, the food good and nourishing. Water and firewood abound nearby. If you do not use this hard-to-find opportunity to practice Zen clearly and thoroughly, you are squandering your life. You are sinking yourself in self-abandonment and willingly abasing yourself to become a low, stupid person. If you feel ignorant about this teaching, why do you not question the elders extensively and ponder on what they say to discover the meaning?" So he's clearly addressing his monks. This is a monastery. These monasteries were full of all kinds of people, including real ne'er-do-wells, according to other records, scholars. So he's trying to inspire them, exhort them to lift themselves out of their state of ignorance. I can't help but thinking, and this description where he's making them aware of how great the conditions are that they find themselves in, I can't help but thinking of Chapin Mill and Arnold Park, for that matter. Your monastery is clean and neat, the food good and nourishing, good water, good air. Everything is lined up for us here. All of these factors have come together in a felicitous way to enable us to practice most effectively. And then he speaks of his own life. He says, I had joined the priesthood at the age of 5. Well, priesthood, monkhood. They were monks then, meaning they had taken vows of lifelong chastity and had cut off ties with their family, become what is usually translated as homeless ones. I had joined the monkhood at the age of 5. When I overheard my teacher discussing this matter with his guests and visitors, then I knew that there was such a thing as Zen, and immediately I had faith in it. Well, he would find out later that no such thing as Zen. Zen is a nothing, a no-thing. Soon I began to learn how to meditate. At 16, I was ordained. So when he says I joined the monkhood, there's the novice period, this extended novice period. But then his final ordination was when he was 16. And he said, at 17, I started travel for study visits. Most of you have heard in my other commentaries on Chinese masters that it was customary in China for many centuries to alternate training period, say 3-month training period, with periods of pilgrimages and travel, where they get a chance to meet other masters. And he says, at the dwelling place of the Master Yuan of Shuanglin, I joined the congregation for meditation. From dawn to sunset, I never left room or court. Court would be the courtyard, I think. The monasteries, even when I was there, had these inner and outer courtyards. Even when I entered the dormitory, I just crossed my hands within my big sleeves and looked straight ahead without seeing anything to the right or to the left. This is what would be the best way to conduct oneself also in Sesshin. Remember, it was quite a turning point for me after I'd been to some Sesshins and had come into the Zendo during break periods or during Yaza and had to check out who else was there sitting. And then that turning point came when I didn't care. Just stepped in, kept my eyes down, had work to do, without inviting comparisons to other people. I just crossed my hands within my big sleeves. The Chinese robes have these very long sleeves, and look straight ahead without seeing anything to the right or the left. I fixed my eyes on a spot about 3 feet ahead of me. In the beginning, I concentrated on the word wu. Wu is the Chinese version of mu. So the original, where the Joshu responded to the monk who asked about whether a dog has Buddha nature, The word he used was "wu," and then but the same meaning in Japanese is conveyed by the word "mu." One day I suddenly turned my mind inward, seeking to discover where and how the thought first arose. Instantly I felt as if my mind had become frozen. It became clear, serene, and limpid, neither moving nor shaking. The whole day seemed like a passing second. I did not even hear the sounds of drums and bells, which occurred at regular intervals in the monastery. This report of not hearing the sounds of drums and bells, compare this to the idea of mindfulness. Mindfulness is where you wouldn't miss any sounds. And that is a pretty... pretty good state to be in. But this is when you don't even hear them, is what I would call a state of no-mindedness. It's a kind of a trance-like state, but trance is misleading. Well, look at the passage right before it. He said, "I felt as if my mind had become frozen. It became clear, serene, and limpid, neither moving nor shaking." This is a samadhi, a deep samadhi state that he's in, a deep state of absorption. Somewhere in Hakuin's autobiography, he reports feeling like he was encased in a sheet of ice extending 10,000 miles. These states sound so remote, so exotic and mysterious, but they're not. You can reach these states. Not that we're trying to reach these states. We're not trying to reach any state. If you're working on a koan, you're trying to resolve to come to understand the koan. But on the way there, one can slip into this kind of a samadhi where everything seems to stop. Why? Because the mind has stopped. Things are things because of mind. He's describing a state of complete stillness of mind, in which the world, so-called, the world becomes still. Time stops. The whole day, he says, seemed like a passing second. When I was 19, I stayed at the Lin Yin Monastery as a visiting monk. Meanwhile, I had received a letter from Chu Chao. There are no footnotes or anything, who these people are. So we'll just read what it says. I had received a letter from Chu Chao, which said, "Dear Chin, your Zen is a dead Zen. That which you have been working on is like dead water, useless. Your work is to divide activity and inactivity into two." So perhaps this author, this Shui Yan, has become attached to sitting and hasn't realized that Zen practice is not just sitting, it's a carrying into all of our activities this mind of stillness, this mind of stabilized awareness. this writer said, the important thing in Zen work is to arouse the feeling of doubt or questioning. Most of you know that in Zen, when we talk about doubt, we're referring to the doubt sensation, this state of perplexity or questioning that you want to work with in working on a koan, or that even if you don't want to work with it, if you're working seriously on a koan, sooner or later, this questioning will grip you. What is mu? What is it? What is this? Who am I? The translator here renders this as the feeling of inquiry doubt. But let's just say doubt. It means questioning. A small doubt will bring a small enlightenment, and a greater doubt will bring forth a great enlightenment. And that's the end of what this friend of his wrote. And then he said, Chu Chao's words hit the mark. Observing the Hua Do from different angles, I constantly doubted this and doubted that. Hua Do is the Chinese word meaning the nub of the koan. So again, referring to the koan mu, what they would call the koan or the kunan is the whole story. You know, a monk once asked Joshu, in all seriousness, does even a dog have Buddha nature? Joshu replied, mu. But the wado is the nub there, just the word mu, or in China wu. I constantly questioned. As a result, I was besieged by drowsiness and errant thoughts. I could not hold a single moment of peace in my mind. So he's probably, if that happened, he's probably working with his head. That is, he was trying to figure it out, which is a mistake. A koan cannot be figured out, especially initial koan, a breakthrough koan like mu. Figure out implies the mind, our discriminating mind, our analytical mind. It's impossible to figure a koan out. And then maybe because of that, he found himself in this state of errant thoughts. Real questioning is to be done with the hara, the belly. Maybe he was asking why questions, why this, why that, the way children do. And that's not going to set the mind at rest. I then went to Chin Tzu Monastery and banded together with seven brethren of Dharma there. We vowed to meditate in a most strict manner. We put aside our quilts and refused to lie down on our beds. That's a thing they would do in China, the most diligent monks would take a vow not to lie down. We refused to lie down on our beds. The head monk, Brother Xu, remained outside our room. Every day when he sat down on the meditation seat, he appeared as steady and immovable as an iron pole thrust into the ground. When he walked, he opened his eyes and dropped his arms so that he still looked like an iron pole. No one could become intimate or talk with him. In other words, he was so completely devoted to just this one matter that he had no time for socializing. It's not something that we need to aspire to shut out others, but when you're in the grip of this great aspiration where you clearly see that there is no time to waste, that you want to devote every single moment to just concentrated awareness, well, then it happens. It may not even have been this head monk's choice. It just was something he felt compelled to do. Now he starts the next paragraph. For 2 years, I did not lie down. Then one day I became so tired that I gave up and lay down and had a good sleep. Oh, yeah, sure, go ahead. Lazy bones. 2 months passed before I collected myself and was ready to work again. The relaxation I had had in those 2 months refreshed me. I felt very vigorous and lively. From this experience, I learned that if one wants to understand this matter, he cannot go completely without sleep. A sound sleep at midnight is necessary to refresh oneself. Well, I think in the traditional Chinese monastery, wake up would be at 2:30 or 3. So, you know, if he found that going to bed at midnight would get him a couple of 90-minute sleep cycles. It's what I would got when I would when I was working on Mu. It averaged, I think, between 2 and 3 hours. I think I could have used more. It might have helped me be more alert in the Zendo, but who knows? It's very hard to second-guess these things. What was clear was I needed to do what I did. I needed to go with that little sleep every night of Sesshin. In Japan, it's become the custom there for a monk at his first seven-day Sesshin, to not sleep at all, or at least not officially. When I was there, I could see monks in the middle of the night in the Zendo sitting in full lotus, flopped over asleep on the tan. He continues, one day I noticed the head monk, Shu, that's the iron pole, by the balustrade. This was the first time I had an opportunity to speak with him. For the past year, I have wanted to talk to you. Why do you always avoid me? I asked. Shu replied, one who really practices the way has no time even to cut his nails. Who has the leisure to talk to you? I then asked him what to do about the drowsiness and errant thoughts which afflicted me. He said, oh, you think he's going to, you know, be warm and understanding about it? And empathetic. He said, these things happen because you are not earnest enough. You should sit erect on your seat, keep your spine straight, make your whole body and mind become one with the koan, and pay no attention to drowsiness or wild thoughts. So then this Shui Yan worked, says, in accord with his instructions. And he says, I unknowingly forgot both my body and mind, even their very existence. For 3 days and three nights my mind stayed so serene and clear that I never closed my eyes for a single moment. On the afternoon of the third day, this, by the way, was after he had come to the conclusion that a sound sleep is necessary at midnight. For 3 days and nights my mind stayed so serene and clear that I never closed my eyes for a single moment. On the afternoon of the third day, I walked through the three gates of the monastery as if I were sitting. Again, in these Chinese monasteries, the big ones, they would have three concentric courtyards, or three gates with a wall, three concentric walls, enclosures. He walked through the three gates of the monastery as if I were sitting. That's what we want, is to have that same rooted concentration in motion. Again, I came across the head monk, Xu. "What are you doing here?" he asked. "Working on the Tao," I answered, or doing my practice. He then said, "What is this you call the Tao?" The Tao means the way, the Dharma. Not able to answer him, I became more confused and perplexed. With the intention of meditating further, I turned back toward the meditation hall. But accidentally, I met Xu again. Can't get away from him. He said, "Just open your eyes and see what it is." After this admonishment, I was even more anxious to return to the meditation hall than before. As I was just going to sit down, something broke abruptly before my face as if the ground were sinking away. I wanted to tell how I felt, but I could not express it. Most of these states, these powerful states that come as the result of long, hard sitting, are difficult to describe. I could not express it. Nothing in this world can be used as a simile to describe it. Immediately I went to find Xu, the head monk. As soon as he saw me, he said, "Congratulations, congratulations." Holding my hand, he led me out of the monastery. Now there you get a sense of a real spiritual friend who didn't want to be socializing with our hero here, the Shui Yan, until he saw that it had this breakthrough, and then this warm friendliness. Holding the hand of another monk, this is something also that you see. It's not so forbidden in China. When we went to Bodhidharma's monastery, Shaolin Temple, the abbot there, he was probably in his 80s. He looked like he was in his 80s. When he met Roshi Kaplo, he took him by the hand and led him through the monastery. Holding my hand, he led me out of the monastery. We walked along the river dike, which was full of willow trees. I looked up at the sky and down at the earth. I actually felt that all phenomena and manifestations, the things I saw with my eyes and heard with my ears, the things that disgusted me, including the passion desires and the blindnesses, in other words, his own defilements, his own afflictions, all flowed out from my own bright, true, and marvelous mind. During the next fortnight, no moving phenomena appeared in my mind. It's hard to know what this was, what this experience was. it could have been just an even deeper kind of samadhi that he got into. And if it wasn't some kind of awakening, I would say, conclude that because of what follows here. He says, "Unfortunately, at that time I had no advanced Zen master to instruct me. Thus I mistakenly lingered in such a state for many years." See, that wouldn't be the case with a genuine awakening. The awakening is not a state that you can linger in or not linger in. It's just awakening, waking up to things as they are. "Thus I mistakenly lingered in such a state for many years. This is the so-called state wherein, quote, the view is not thorough, therefore it hinders genuine understanding. I could not hold the view while sleeping. At this stage, I could grasp the koans that were intelligible, but whenever I met any of those impenetrable, silver mountain-like koans, those iron wall-like koans, I could not understand them at all. Although I had practiced for many years under my deceased teacher, Wu Chun, none of his private discussions or public talks struck my heart. None of the Zen books or sutras meant much to me. This obstacle was an oppression within my heart and breast for 10 years. So this state, he was in this state, it sounds like, for 10 years. Then one day, when I was walking in the hall of Tien Mao Monastery, I lifted my head and saw a cypress tree standing before me. Suddenly, in a flash, I understood. The experience heretofore gained and the obstacle weighing upon my heart and breast all melted away. The feeling was akin to experiencing the bright sun shining suddenly into a dark room. From that time on, I had no doubts about birth and death, no questions about the Buddha and the ancestors. So this surely, from the description, this was a profound realization. But look what preceded it. All of this self-punishing, not lying down for 2 years, and he probably just scratches the surface of the description of what he went through all those years. He sums up in one sentence, 10 years. Given his complete dedication to his practice, we can assume that even after these earlier experiences, he sat probably day and night for those next 10 years. But it doesn't require those years of day and night sitting in order to have an initial glimpse into the nature of reality, an initial kensho. It helps to sit a lot, as we do in sesshin. That's where most awakening experiences happen, in sesshin. So don't anyone make the mistake of thinking that if you're not in these wildly deep states, or you forget everything, that you can't break through your koan. You can. But it takes commitment. Here's another story by a master, Meng Shan. "When I was 20 years old, I already knew of this matter, that is Zen. From that time on until I was 32, I practiced with some 18 elders to learn. Elders would mean teachers, maybe in our way of rendering it. I trained with some 18 teachers to learn how actually to practice Zen. So that's 12 years, 20 to 32. Nevertheless, I received no clear-cut teaching from them. This is so Zen-like. Zen teaching is not the same as instruction. It can include some instruction, for sure. But the real teaching comes from the sitting. The real teacher is within oneself. Later, I trained with the elder of Wanshan, who taught me to work on the Wu word, again, Mu. In doing so, he said that one should, in the 12 periods of a day, be ever alert like a cat waiting to catch a mouse, or like a hen intent on hatching an egg, never letting up on the task. That the monastery day, the 24-hour day, was divided into two-hour periods. So that's the reference to 12 periods of a day. He continues, until one is fully and thoroughly enlightened, he should keep on working uninterruptedly like a mouse gnawing at a coffin. If one can keep practicing in such a manner, in time he will definitely discover the way. Following these instructions, I meditated and contemplated diligently day and night for 18 days. Then, while I was drinking a cup of tea, I suddenly understood the purport of Buddha's holding up the flower and of Mahakashapa's smile to him. This is the very famous story of where the Buddha transmitted the Dharma to his first disciple, on the mountain of Vulture Peak, where he just stood before the assembly of monks and held up a flower, twirled it, some sources say, and only Mahakashapa smiled in response, and the Buddha said, I now transmit to you the Dharma. Delight overwhelmed me. Delight is a wonderful word for experience of awakening. Another source, I can't remember what it was, it just it's etched in my mind, my brain, from hearing Roshi Kapo's Teisho, where a master described being in a samadhi of innocent delight. I questioned three or four elders about my experience, but they said nothing. That too is very Zen-like. Instead of congratulating him or making a big thing of it, they just see it as a decisive step on this path. The danger always when one has an awakening is that one then comes to cling to it, the thought of it, and then it can curdle and become an attachment, the thought of having achieved something. They said nothing. Several of the elders told me to identify my experience with the ocean seal samadhi and to disregard all else. Their advice led me to an easy confidence in myself. There's a footnote here. This ocean seal samadhi is the samadhi of Buddhahood. Since the ocean is the destination of all rivers and is also a great mirror that is capable of reflecting all manifestations in the world, it is figuratively used to describe the all-reflecting wisdom of Buddhahood now expressed in the term samadhi. This expression is frequently used by Zen scholars. So, in other words, a profound samadhi. 2 years after this, I contracted dysentery at Chongqing in Sichuan province. My bowels moved 100 times a day and brought me to the brink of death. All my former understanding became useless, and the so-called ocean seal samadhi did not help me in the least. I had a body, but I could not move. I possessed a mouth, but I could not speak. I lay down, just waiting for death. All the karmas and other fearful hallucinations appeared simultaneously before me. Frightened, puzzled, and lost, I felt crushed, annihilated under pressures and miseries. With the thought of approaching death before me, I forced myself to make a will, and so disposed of all my worldly affairs. As a monk, probably consisted of his robe number one, his robe number two, and his sandals. This accomplished, I slowly pulled myself up, burned a full censer of incense, and seated myself steadily on a high seat. There I prayed silently to the three precious ones, maybe Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's hard with the translations. And the gods in the heavens, repenting before them of all the transgressions I had committed in life. Yeah, so they're... prayer, or at least petitionary prayer, is not something that you hear about much in Zen practice, but there are no atheists in foxholes. I then made my last petition. If my life is about to end, I wish through the powers of prajna and a sober state of mind that I may be reborn in a favorable place wherein I may become a monk at an early age. If by chance I recover from this illness, though, I will renounce the world, become a monk, and strive to bring enlightenment to young Buddhists everywhere. Oh yeah, so, okay, this guy wasn't a monk yet. Having made this vow, I then took up the wu word and observed it inwardly. Before long, my bowels rolled and twisted a number of times, but I ignored them. After I had sat for a long while, I felt my eyelids become fixed steadfastly. Again, a long period of time elapsed in which I did not feel the presence of my body at all. There was nothing but the koan continuously presenting itself in my mind. It was not until night that I rose from my seat. I had half recovered from my illness. I sat again and meditated until after midnight. By then, my recovery was complete. Both my body and my mind felt comfortable and light. You know, you read this kind of a story, and there are and more than a few that we've read from about the Zen masters in China and Japan. Read these stories, and how can you not have faith in the power, the unfathomable power of spiritual devotion, of a concentrated mind? Unless you claim that this can't be so, we are left to conclude that mind trumps everything. The power of a unified mind, the power of devotion, of faith, above all faith. So the greatest treasure we can possibly have in life and in approaching death. By then my recovery was complete. Both my body and my mind felt comfortable and light. Well, this account continues. We'll have to pick it up tomorrow and stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.